The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Another glorious day here on the Edstone campus. I think the weather all week, sunny and in the low 80s. So just beautiful, beautiful weather. We got outside this morning, early this morning before the work day with our workout crew. Did some jump roping and a few other exercises out on the patio. Very refreshing, for sure. Well, today we're going to talk about conflict and division as opposed to unity and peace. Today happens to be the 73rd anniversary of the signing of the United Nations Charter in San Francisco back in 1945. And the opening line of that charter says that we, the people of the United Nations, determine to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, they wrote in 1945, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small. Just this year, earlier, a couple of months ago, according to the UN News, that's the UN website, it paraphrases the UN chief, who said that more countries today are experiencing violent conflict than at any time in nearly three decades. And that record numbers of people are on the move, displaced by violence, war, and persecution. So it's not been a smooth ride for the United Nations these past 73 years. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, he was quoted in that same article from April earlier this year. He said, inequalities are increasing. Whole regions, countries, and communities can find themselves isolated from progress and left behind by growth. These are all indications that we need greater unity and courage, he said, to ease the fears of the people we serve and to set the world on track to a better future. And they're looking at new ways to try to prevent conflict. The Secretary General admitted that a lot of what they try to do is to just put aid toward existing conflicts. They haven't prevented conflict. It just hasn't worked. It's produced more division and strife. Certainly not peace during the past 73 years. During these 73 years of the United Nations, there have been well over 250 armed conflicts between nations. That's an average of something like three or four wars per year, and there's no end in sight. Now, what's amazing, and you've heard some of this before, you know about it if you've read Herbert Armstrong's autobiography. He was at that first UN gathering in San Francisco in 1945. And he saw the seeds being planted in 1945, not for peace and unity, but for conflict and division, for strife, for war. In his autobiography, Mr. Armstrong wrote, they said that we were gathered there, charged with the grave responsibility of producing a world organization that was civilization's last hope. They assured the delegates assembled that that the survival of mankind depended on what they should do there. Mr. Armstrong wrote, I wondered whether they realized how true their words really were, so far as man's efforts to survive are concerned. He talked about the many speeches that he and his wife heard at that gathering. They were painting a grim picture. They said, this is our last hope. This is our last opportunity to preserve the peace, to keep the peace. I mean, we've seen these two world wars in our lifetime. 73 years on from that, well, we haven't yet had the world war, but there certainly have been wars and rumors of wars, as Jesus prophesied. And there is coming great tribulation, as Jesus also prophesied. Mr. Armstrong, in one of his oldest radio broadcasts, this is from November of 1945. We don't have the audio, unfortunately, but he said in that program that the war is over. This is just months after the war ended. We won it, he said, just barely, and by the skin of our teeth. And most of us do not realize it. We don't realize, he said, just how close we came to losing that war. I mean, there is, if you know some of the history and the lead up to it, there's all kinds of places that the Allies could have prevented the war from ever happening if they would have stood up to Hitler. But then as the Nazi machine gathered momentum and strength, I mean, Britain was alone in 1940, and the United States wanted no part of it. We came very, very close to losing it. Mr. Armstrong said in that 1945 broadcast, he said, and now where are we? Where? We face a world crisis far more serious and fraught with danger, far greater than we faced during the anxious days of Berchtesgaden and Munich. We stand now at the most dangerous hour of American history, all the more dangerous, because we do not realize the danger. We have let down, and lethargy has seized us. That's a strong warning from 1945. We've let down. Who can deny this today? We, in Principles of Living here at the college, we talk about the post-war relaxation of morals. That's often the case. Coming out of a long, hard, and difficult struggle, and of course at that time the United States was about to enter into a period of just incredible prosperity. Riches and wealth, the most powerful and prosperous nation in history. But yet look at the morality, or lack thereof. Lethargy has seized us, Mr. Armstrong said. And also speaking of the college courses, Richard Palmer reminded me this morning of his textbook for international relations, Hans Morgenthau's book, Politics Among Nations. And he's talking here in this section, I'll quote for you, about the problem, whether it's international politics or domestic issues, whatever it is. Morgenthau says, the essence of international politics is identical with its domestic counterpart. Both domestic and international politics are a struggle for power, modified only by the different conditions under which this struggle takes place in the domestic and international spheres. And so as he goes on to explain here, whatever it is, whatever the organizations, whatever groups come together, whether in the home or all the way up to the nations against nations, fundamentally, I mean, the differences, they come down to this struggle for power. He says social clubs, fraternities, faculties, and business organizations are scenes of continuous struggles for power between groups that either want to keep the power they already have or seek to attain greater power. Competitive contests between business enterprises, as well as labor disputes between employers and employees, are frequently fought not only, and sometimes not even primarily, for economic advantages, but for control over each other and over others. That is, for power. We went through that the other day with respect to George Orwell's book, 1984. And how that the radical left, what they want, what they crave, what they fight for is power. And they've lost power. And you see the way that they're acting in the United States. And is this bringing peace? Is this bringing the United States together? Or is it causing more division, more hatred and strife? Morgenthau says here, finally, the whole political life of a nation, particularly of a democratic nation, from the local to the national level, is a continuous struggle for power. Here's how he concludes this section. In view of this ubiquity of the struggle for power in all social relations and on all levels of social organization, is it surprising that international politics is of necessity power politics? And would it not be rather surprising if the struggle for power were but an accidental and ephemeral attribute of international politics when it is permanent and necessary, a permanent and necessary element of all branches of domestic politics? I mean, it's just top to bottom, the struggle for power. That has been man's history. 6,000 years, thousands upon thousands of wars, armed conflicts, and of course the weapons, they just get more and more powerful and advanced in the technology. And here we are today with something like, what is it, 15, 16,000 nuclear weapons around the earth? You think about that quote by Morgenthau. I'm not sure how old that is or when he was writing it, but it sounds very similar to what Mr. Armstrong was saying back in 1945. He talked in that same broadcast, that 1945 broadcast, about businessmen, how they're against each other, and how it's, he boiled it down to the get versus the give way, and how that whether it's business or commerce or religion, there's competition at the core, politics, business, religion. Even in sports, as he explained in that same program. He says, finally, this is that same program. Speaking of government in particular, he says, there have been various forms of government, but remember this, every single government in the world, of whatever form, whether communism, fascism, autocracy, or yes, even democracy, is merely a different method of administering this same overall Babylonish system. And it's the system which is the root cause of this world's ills and of wars. We're talking about root causes today. Why, when you look at the world today, do you see so much conflict and division and strife? And why is there so little unity and peace? Even when the name says United, United Nations, United States, the European Union. And yet look at the infighting. Look at the violence. Look at the hatred. There is no unity. And the reason for that is because this is not something that God set up or established. That's what Mr. Armstrong was saying coming out of that conference back in 1945. He said, look, I saw it in the halls. I saw them arguing with each other, the foreign minister from Russia and Anthony Eden from Britain, or the U.S. Secretary of State at the time. I forget his name. But they'd come back from these meetings and be all red-faced and hot under the collar and then having to give a speech in front of the press. They couldn't agree. I mean, they were coming off of the worst world war in history. And they couldn't reach an agreement on the basics, the fundamentals of preserving peace. And of course, the reason for it is because God wasn't at the meeting. God wasn't establishing the charter. God wasn't, as Mr. Armstrong said, they just had a moment of silence before the meetings. No prayers. I mean, if ever there's a time to humble ourselves, You come out of a world war where 60 million people were slaughtered? You'd think they'd be willing to drop to their knees in humble submission to God. But instead, they create another man-made organization, not unlike the League of Nations, that would go on to become another one of many abysmal failures. You leave God out of the picture. You don't give God credit or give God thanks, as Paul said in Romans. Then what are you left with? You're just left with your own devices. You're left with your own reprobate thinking. The Apostle John said in 1 John 3 and verse 4, "Whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law." And God's law, as it says in Romans 7 and verse 14, is spiritual. It takes the Spirit of God to understand and to even observe the laws of God. It takes the Spirit of God to live the way of love. John said in the same book, "For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not grievous." Paul said in Romans 13 that love fulfills the law. God's law is love. That's what God is. 1 John 4:8. And so when we fill up on the Spirit of God and submit to God's authority and government, then we're obeying the law of love. And that's how you solve the problems of this world. When all the families, when all the communities, when all the governments, when all the nations are observing the laws of God, are established on the foundation of God's law, then we'll see some progress. Now, the exciting thing is, we're not that far away from that time. Jesus Christ returned to this earth. We are not that far away from the wonderful world of tomorrow. But when you look at the world of today, it's certainly not wonderful. There's no peace. There is no peace. What did the Secretary General say? Well, we just see an escalation of these things. It's worse. It's worse. Human rights, conflict, inequalities are increasing. Whole regions, he said. Countries are finding themselves isolated from progress. 73 years on, why is the world the way it is today? Well, Isaiah answers, Isaiah 59 and verse 8. We've read it before. "The way of peace they know not." Man doesn't know the way to peace. There is a way. That's the thing. And we'll talk more on that later on in the program. But we don't know the way to peace. That's why there's so much fighting and division. As Mr. Armstrong wrote in the Wonderful World Tomorrow booklet, governments promise peace, but they bring wars. They promise benefits for the people and then extract from the people the cost of the benefits plus excessive costs of government. Government promises are empty. The people are the pawns who fork over the money in order to get part of it back. We fail to find in human government any knowledge of life's purpose or dissemination of the true values. Where is there a government on earth today that is striving for peace based upon true values, based upon the laws of God? Well, there's people striving for peace. They're working hard for peace. I'm sure there's several inside the United Nations who are sincerely working for peace. There's others inside that same group, of course, that don't want it at all. And they don't even try to conceal it. Their hatred for the United States or for Israel. There is a way to peace, but man doesn't know the way. We talk about it. We cry out, "Peace and peace and more peace," when there is no peace, as Jeremiah the prophet said. It's as if the more we talk about it, the more violence and division and strife there is. As Mr. Armstrong concluded, you take a hard, cold, realistic view of conditions and trends, they do point inevitably to a fast approaching world crisis of combined nuclear war, starvation, uncontrollable disease epidemics, crime and violence, and extinction of human life on this planet. I mean, just take a cold, hard look at the fact. Listen to what the UN itself is saying. And yet, what did Mr. Armstrong say in that 1945 program? Well, we've gone to sleep. Lethargy has seized us. We're not paying attention. We think the world is getting better and better as we escape away from the realities of this world to our gadgets and time-wasting devices, to entertainment and sports. The psalm says, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchmen wake but in vain. See, Herbert Armstrong, as I said, he was at that initial meeting with the United Nations. He was there in 1945 in San Francisco. And during that same time, the meetings went on for a number of weeks, as I recall. And during that same time, Mr. Armstrong set up a meeting of his own with some of his own co-workers. And he told this private audience of his, here is why this United Nations is not going to bring peace. All of these leaders, they've gathered together. They've tried to build up this high tower, as Mr. Armstrong said. He relates this in his autobiography, comparing it to the Tower of Babel. And he asks, can it succeed? He said, the Lord God is not building this house. That's Psalm 127 and verse 1. God's not building it. And so it can't succeed. It won't succeed. But as he said, in the end, God Almighty will have to intervene with force to break up what will grow out of this effort of nations to assemble themselves together without God. Whatever it is that we build, we want God to be the builder. We want God to be right in the middle of it. Otherwise, it won't work. Otherwise, it'll come crashing down at the first sign of trouble. When we come back, we'll just highlight more of the bitter divisions that we see in our society today. I mean, not only has man gone it alone and built up his own house, but you see, as in the case of the United States, I mean, you see the house so bitterly, bitterly divided. And Jesus, of course, added that a house divided can't stand. It won't work. A nation divided cannot stand. It won't survive. We'll look at that more in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is, We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
America has a serious problem on its southern border, and the nation is deeply divided about that problem and many others. And did you know that that immigration problem is actually prophesied in your Bible?
That's a program my father gave back in August of 2014, almost 4 years ago, when really people from Central and South America were just flooding across the border into the United States. All of these young people, these unaccompanied minors. And Barack Obama had to build a lot of cages. He had to build up a lot of detention centers for these tens of thousands of illegal immigrants. And it's a serious problem, as my father said in that program. And America was deeply divided over it back then. And it's a lot of the reason why Donald Trump got 63 million votes 2 years ago. Well, he took you through some prophecies in the Bible from the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 28 and elsewhere, pointing out what God says about what's going to happen to our nations just being overrun with all of these immigrants. Open borders, that's what the radical left wants. This is a history, recent history, that many in the media, of course, would like for you to forget. I'll play a clip for you here in just a second, where after his exchange, the president yesterday met with Jordan's king, King Abdullah, and as soon as they wrapped things up, I mean, then the media started shouting out in ways that you never saw it happen during the Obama years. No respect. No love for this president, that's for sure. You can count on that at any press conference. What we're not used to seeing is a president who actually fights back a little bit, as you'll hear from one of these clips. But let me first just start by playing for you. This is at the end of his exchange, the president's, with King Abdullah. And then listen to what King Abdullah has to say in return to President Trump. This is clip 10.
And I just want to say, well, our nations have a very good relationship. We now have a great relationship, but the job you do on a humanitarian basis is fantastic. And I would like to thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. And, sir, if I can thank you and the United States and the people of America for all the support you've given our country. If the rest of the world just took a little bit of your humility and your grace to help us, we'd be in a lot better position. But if it wasn't the United States, just on behalf of myself and my people, thank you so much for all that you've done.
Wow, you don't hear that very often. Someone that's just profusely grateful for America's assistance and who comments on President Trump's humility and grace. If the rest of the world just took a little bit of your humility and grace, we'd be in a lot better position. Jordan has had its struggles with refugees. And the president commended King Abdullah on how he's handled his situation. It's not unlike dozens and dozens of countries around the world. It's just like the UN Secretary General said. I mean, we're just seeing more and more conflict and inequality and refugees on the run. And the United States has its serious problem, as my father said in that 2014 program, on its southern border as well. So after King Abdullah commends President Trump for his humility, something I'm sure the media in the room did not appreciate. President Trump wraps it up, and then listen to the media reaction, and then President Trump finally does interject and say a few things. This is clip 11.
Thank you very much, everybody. The executive order was great. It was something that I felt we had to do. We want children staying together. The law has been this law for a long period of time. You would understand this better than most because of the great job you do in your country. There was a false story, fake news in the New York Times, just the opposite. I wanted to sign that. In fact, I was saying yesterday before I read this phony story in the New York Times that I was very, very happy that I signed that. And it also, it shows, you know, we're all talking about humanity, whether it's what you're doing in Jordan or whether it's what we're doing here. The laws are obsolete. The laws are horrible having to do with the border, both in terms of security and in terms of taking care of people. President Obama had a big problem. In fact, a lot of the pictures used, they thought would be, I guess, I don't know what you folks did. You used pictures from 2014. They were all taken during the Obama administration. But the Bush administration had the same. It's the same laws. They're a disaster. The laws have to be changed.
Same laws, same problems, going back decades. President Bush, he didn't do anything about it. President Obama didn't do anything about it. He made it worse. He made it worse by wanting to keep so many of them in. And then they got the news of that in Central America. And they came streaming across in 2014. So much so that the Obama administration had to install more cages, had to build more camps, just using the media's words, had to build more detention centers, had to build more internment facilities. Well, listen to how the president wrapped up his news conference yesterday, or really, he just made some comments briefly before the media, insisted that he answer some questions. Okay, you signed this executive order. You signed it last week to bring the families together. But now we heard from the New York Times you didn't really want to sign it. We heard that you're really not sincere. And of course, we've been hearing all week that you're a Nazi. That you're just like Adolf Hitler. And the president's response, as you just heard there, was, no, that's fake news. I was happy to sign that order. The laws, though, the laws that have been on the books since before the Trump administration, since before the Obama administration, since before the Bush administration, those laws do need to be fixed. And we need something that's simple and effective, as he went on to explain. Here's clip 12.
We want a system where when people come in illegally, they have to go out. And a nice, simple system that works. You know, Mexico holds people for 4 hours, for 5 hours, for 2 hours, and they're gone. We have people for 4, 5, 6 years, and they never leave. So we want to have a great immigration. What we have is very simple. We want strong borders, and we want no crime. Strong borders, we want no crime. The Democrats want open borders, and they don't care about crime.
It's a pretty straightforward message. Can you see why 63 million Americans voted for him? That's a message that resonates with a lot of people. And it makes everyone in that press gathering very uncomfortable. The truth hurts. They want open borders, and they don't care about crime. And he's right about that because they don't report it. They don't tell you about MS-13. They don't tell you about the criminal element. And when you bring it up, they turn it on you and say that, well, you're calling all the immigrants criminals. You can't even bring it up. You can't even address the problem. And here is a president who's trying. We'll see how much success he has. He seems pretty confident. But he's trying to address the problem. A system where when people come in illegally, they have to go back. Well, the prophecies, as my father brought out in that 2014 article, or program rather, the prophecies suggest that this is not going to end anytime soon. But a lot of Americans see what's going on. And a lot of Americans know that without strong borders, you don't have a country. What would any, like I said the other day, what would any other nation be doing? What, as he said, what does Mexico do? What is Europe struggling to do? What would an African nation do? Or a Southeast Asian nation? How would Japan approach this? Just a nonstop stream of illegal immigrants. What would the crackdown be like? Well, as far as people in his own country, enemies in his own country, well, they see what Donald Trump is doing as very similar to what Adolf Hitler did. Listen to what Joe Scarborough said on MSNBC yesterday morning. This is clip six.
We're going to have Jeremy Peters on later today. Jeremy wrote a story that the more Donald Trump is attacked, whether it's for lying, and they admit that, so many admit that he's a liar, whether it's for just overt racism, which now has gone from sort of a seasoning at the beginning of the campaign to literally the central driving principle of his presidency. You look at the press conferences that he's holding, you look at the statements that he's making, the central defining nature of his presidency now has to do with attacking people who are not white.
So you can see why they're now moving on to the final stage of this accusation that he's Hitler, that everyone who voted for him, all 63 million, well, they must be Nazis too. After all, I mean, the central driving principle of his presidency is overt racism. Overt racism. He is only concerned about attacking people who are not white. Yesterday, I think this was actually from Sunday, this bit from Maxine Waters. I mean, this is so over the top that even some in her own party are telling her to tone it down. This was from a rally at her home or in front of her constituents on Sunday, clip seven.
You have members of your cabinet that have been booed out of restaurants. Who have protesters taking up at their house. Who saying no peace, no sleep. And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome.
That's Maxine Waters saying push back. Track them down at the restaurant, at the gas station. You push back. You create a crowd. You tell them they are not welcome. They're not welcome in their own country. Now, Barack Obama was a little more diplomatic with the way that he said it, but he had statements too where he said, you show up to a fight with a weapon. Make sure you show up with a weapon, so to speak. And here's Maxine Waters calling for violence. As I say, this is so over the top that Chuck Schumer is saying, you better calm down. And it's actually happening. We're not that far removed from violence. I mean, after all, if it's Hitler and it's 63 million Nazis, we've got to stop it. We've got to tell them they are not welcome. And there's the Sarah Sanders incident over the weekend. And at The Hill, this columnist here, he talks about last week being a turning point. The rinse and repeat cycle of anti-Trump outrage blared on nearly every news network, magazine, and newspaper has fomented an increasingly brazen brand of radical ideas turning into radical action. That's what's frightening here is it's turning into radical action. And last week appears to be a turning point, as this article says. And when you talk about, well, it brings out later on in the piece, the media that's just duped, going along with it. Trump is Hitler, Trump is Hitler, Trump is Hitler. It refers to that Ben Rhodes bit from a couple of years ago. Remember when he talked about he talked about reporters, how a lot of them are in their 20s and they literally know nothing. He said, look, Ben Rhodes himself said it. And so you have all of these these reporters who really don't know much about history. They've just gone through a left-wing journalism school. The media's sickness is terminal, says the American Spectator. And it highlights in this piece, again, the hypocrisy here. One of the media's favorite refrains against Donald Trump in 2016 was that he lacked the temperament and the maturity to govern. The charge was usually leveled at the most ill-tempered, immature journalists, imaginable. It is typical of the left, which owns almost all of the media, to demand civility of its opponents while granting itself limitless incivilities. In the grip of government power, when they need to tame their opposition, liberals will pompously talk about the rules of decorum. As I say, who could imagine journalists shouting at Barack Obama? Well, there was the Daily Caller reporter from, I think, 2012 or 13. He just stood up in the Rose Garden and barked out a question. And President Obama rebuked him. And then he was scolded in the media after that. American Spectator says, but the moment they are out of power, they immediately start breaking them, these rules of decorum, that is. And then, well, it goes into a long laundry list of things that we're seeing now on a daily basis. Victor Davis Hanson had an interview with The Federalist the other day. The reporter here is Ben Weingarten. He's the one asking the questions in this clip that we'll play for you. But he's basically just putting forward a recent piece that Victor Davis Hanson wrote and then asking for him to respond. Here's clip three.
You pose the question in a recent article, and I'll quote, are we reaching a point in the so far failed resistance where little is left except abject violence in the manner of the Roman or French Revolution? Unquote. Where is this headed?
Well, I don't know. I'd like to ask Kamala Harris, our senator, and she said that what would you do if you were in an elevator with Donald Trump? She said, does he have to come out alive? And then you have this weird assassination chic where a Johnny Depp or Kathleen Griffin or obscure professor who gets in the news or Snoop Dogg will. Should we shoot Trump? Should we incinerate Trump? Should we blow Trump up? Should we stab him to death, the Shakespearean troupe in Central Park, or just behead him? And what that does is it creates a climate, especially when you say almost daily that he's Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin. Well, what do you do if somebody believes he's Stalin? You do what they advocate. Nobody likes Stalin or Hitler, so you get rid of Stalin. And so that's the climate of delegitimizing Trump that we're seeing, and it's all a frustration that the unimaginable, the unthinkable happened in 2016. Donald Trump, against every measure of expectation, poll, survey, won the election. And a lot of people were engaged in activity to ensure that he didn't. Had he lost the election, they would be rewarded right now. So James Comey or Andrew McCabe or Loretta Lynch would be going into Hillary's office and say, you know, I met on the tarmac with your husband. I helped you. Or I dropped that email investigation. I need this. Instead, the unimaginable happened. And what they thought were career-enhancing, stretching the law, turned out to be criminality. And I think they're going to have to account for it.
That's Victor Davis Hanson at The Federalist. just talking about the climate of our day politically. And all of these people, on the one hand, running for cover that were caught now in all of these acts of criminality. But before he mentioned that, I mean, just all those, he's Hitler, he's Mussolini, he's Stalin. Should we blow him up? Should we stab him to death? Should we incinerate the president? I mean, this is all going on daily. It's routine. These statements are on the major cable networks, all over social media. And the ones that get a slap on the wrist, I mean, they might be gone for a few weeks, but then they come back. And, of course, quite a lot of them. There's no punishment. The things that are being said. Where is it leading? Just like Victor Davis Hanson asked. Where is it leading the United States? And, of course, the thing of it is, this is what the U.S. is broadcasting all over the world. The rest of the world gets to view what's taking place. And it's nice to hear someone like King Abdullah not just sit there uncomfortably, eager to get out of the meeting, but actually grateful, actually thankful for the support that the U.S. provides to try, listen to this, to try to help Jordan solve its refugee crisis. How much money does the United States send all over the world for countries, two countries that have challenges at their borders? And what are those countries doing? And what are the critics doing? Well, those that hate Donald Trump, they're broadcasting their message far and wide across the United States. And as I say, it's amplified because of today's technologies. It's amplified to where it goes all over the earth. James Comey was in Britain just last week. And listen to what he had to say in an interview on LBC. This is a radio program here in the UK from last week, clip 9.
Explain, you noticed that with Donald Trump. I don't think you ever saw him laugh. Is that right?
I never saw him laugh. And I had a dinner alone with him for about an hour
and a
half. So
no attempt at the chit-chat we did when we walked into the studio together? No attempt at any of that? Not that sort of relating on a human level?
No, he talks nearly the entire time. And it's about him telling you how great he is and seeking your affirmation. But there's no humor, which is deeply concerning in a leader.
That's the former FBI director that was just deemed to be insubordinate. Insubordinate. Not just early on in the Trump presidency, in the final year of Barack Obama's presidency. Insubordinate. He was a loose cannon. He was doing his own thing. He wouldn't check in with the DOJ or the president or anyone else. He did what James Comey wanted to do. And here he is in the United Kingdom talking about the president of the United States being obsessed with himself. Here he is spreading the message of Joe Scarborough. He's taking it right around the world. Is that going to help the United States? Is that going to bring peace and unity to the United States? Is that going to bring peace to the world? Well, he has a captive audience. He's got books to sell. He's got a lot of people in the UK government that happen to agree with him. So they'll treat him like a celebrity. Listen to what this senior Labour Party leader had to say about President Trump's upcoming visit. I think he's due to visit the UK in July. And I failed to get the Labour Party member's name. But listen to what he said about that forthcoming visit. Clip 8.
I just think those pictures of children in cages was heartbreaking. This man is disgusting. He has to come here. He's the president of the United States, and you know, people of the United States voted for him, and we're always going to have a strong friendship with the people of the United States. But let's not make any bones about it. He's foul. It is obnoxious what he is doing. He should not have been putting those children in cages. And also, it's not just that. It's the fact he's pulled out of all the climate change agreements. It's the stuff he's trying to do or is doing on steel tariffs. He is making the world less safe. He's making the world more polluted. He's making the world less secure. I mean, look, I understand why he's going to go here, or come here, but let's not give him any red carpet or make it a pleasant experience. Right?
Let's not make it a pleasant experience for the president of the United States. So says this senior Labor Party member. Now, I'm assuming it would be quite different if he showed up to Amman, Jordan, judging by King Abdullah's remarks yesterday. But when he comes to the United Kingdom, when he visits London, when he visits Whitehall, when he visits number 10 Downing Street, let's not roll out the red carpet. Let's not make it a pleasant experience for him. I mean, he's putting children in cages. There he is, just echoing what he hears from left-wing broadcasters. And that amounts to about 90% of the media over there in the United States. And it's the same here. Richard Palmer's got a trumpet brief coming out just today. You watch for it in your email inbox about how the EU is grappling with its immigration crisis. Richard just gave me a rough draft. It may come out a little bit different than what I read here. But he goes through the case of one refugee in particular who only saw sunlight for a few seconds each day. She's locked inside of a room. Guards handing her a daily ration of food. And of course, the journey to try to get into the EU, to try to get into European countries, is not unlike the one for those trying to get from Honduras or Nicaragua up to the United States. Rape, torture, all kinds of abuse. Richard says this Amy tried to flee from Eritrea to Europe. And for 10 months, she was brutalized by traffickers. A Libyan Coast Guard intercepted her, took her to one of the detention centers in Tripoli. As I said to you yesterday on the show, this is what Europe's now thinking. Proposed by Italy, we've got to set up more detention centers in Libya, on the African continent. Deal with the problem there. Don't let them in here. Her experience is common, Richard says. In that center in Tripoli, 1,000 people are shut in a dark warehouse. During the day, they can use the bathroom, but at night, they're locked in. The numbers kept in these types of camps varies, but last November, it was estimated to be 20,000. And this isn't even the tip of the iceberg. Around 500,000 people live in these UN over... The UN oversees it, evidently. Europe's involved. All across the Middle East and North Africa. Trapped, basically, locked in dark warehouses. And here comes this senior Labor Party leader saying, don't roll out the red carpet for President Trump. Don't make it a pleasant experience for him. He's the problem with the immigration crisis. He's the one that won't solve the problems of this world. He's the one that's making this world unsafe, less secure. Where is the solution? Well, there is a solution. There is. I won't have time to get into some of the scriptures I was going to conclude with, Isaiah 2, but let me at least play this clip. This is, again, from my father's Key of David program from 2014, clip 5.
So God says these nations are going to be punished. They're going to be punished for their sins, and the sooner we wake up, the sooner we're going to get rid of all of the problems. And believe me, we're going to get rid of them. We're going to get rid of all of those problems. But God promises to help to deliver you and deliver America and Britain from those problems. And what is going to replace it, I think, will astound you. If you really understand it, it will astound you. This is something that God says all these problems you see in America and Britain is leading into. The conclusion is just utterly mesmerizing in many ways because it is so wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
The prophet Isaiah writes of that time in chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, where it says, all nations are going to flow in and out of Jerusalem, and they're going to be taught the ways of God. They're going to be grounded in the laws of God. It says, for out of Zion shall go forth the law, God's law. Here's the solution. It's God's law. And it goes on and says that nations will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. No more military armaments. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation. It says, neither shall they learn war anymore. That's what we've been learning these past 6,000 years. But soon, at the return of Christ, we'll actually learn the way to peace. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.